You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 16th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Once dubbed the in-flight magazine of Air Force One, today's incarnation of the New Republic has shed much of the influence that made it a hive for America's journalistic elite. It's just one of many prestigious titles whose dominance has waned in the face of increased competition. We lift the covers on America's media from Washington to New York today on The Stack. On today's show, how the mighty fall. As the New Republic goes up for sale once again, we'll take a wider look at America's print media.
His big mistake was treating this magazine as a startup and, you know, not as this kind of like iconic historic legacy publication.
And from respected news weeklies to New York's tabloid wall, after swimming in a pool of vanishing profits and decreasing relevance, is there an end in sight for the Daily News' downwards spiral? Plus, we'll take a time-traveling trip back to when journalism was coming of age in 19th century Manhattan.
As a daily title, selling for 1 cent, Cummings ran the paper as a sort of religious gazette. He penned editorials that sought to uplift the reader and shunned any mention of alcohol, lewd acts, or theatrical material that might offend.
All that coming up on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Ben Rylan, sitting in for Tyler Brille this week. We heard news late in the week that the New Republic magazine was up for sale yet again. Chris Hughes bought the prestigious title back in 2012, but dark clouds seemed to form above the magazine's Washington headquarters almost immediately. Hughes, of course, was once a roommate with Mark Zuckerberg and made a fortune helping create the ultimate symbol of non-print media in the age of the internet, Facebook. The New Republic sits in stark contrast to that, a beacon of the old guard that sources its power by operating as a showcase for the best voices working in journalism. Things eventually erupted in 2014 when a mass exodus of staff forced the cancellation of its December issue. But let's be clear, the problems at the New Republic were certainly not created by Chris Hughes, and his sale of the title is more an admission of personal priorities than professional failure. Many figures with equally deep pockets have come in and out of the magazine's doors before him. So where does the magazine fit in today's media landscape? Joe Pompeo is a senior reporter for Politico Media, and he joins me today from Monocle's New York Bureau. Joe, welcome. The New Republic has certainly had a checkered history. It's always carried this weight of being prestigious and influential, but it seems to have rarely operated as a successful business. In your opinion, do you think it's enough to simply aim for influence?
That's right. I mean, it's a matter of the types of the people who are writing, the people who are reading. And you're right, the New Republic always has been, you know, a fairly niche in a lot of ways. It's circulation belies its influence in the political culture. I think, you know, this has always been a publication that's had a readership in print in the tens of thousands, not the hundreds of thousands, certainly not the millions. And it has always been a money loser. And it's the type of publication that is valuable because it is influential, because the President of the United States is reading it on Air Force One, you know, and that's something that has a lot of currency. And I think the people who, you know, before Chris Hughes owned the magazine were wealthy individuals who, you know, believed in the value and the mission of this influential publication, and, you know, were willing to lose money on it. And I think that's the type of publication it is. It's something that does not have a clear business model in this day and age, and probably needs an owner who, you know, wants it because they believe in the mission and are probably willing to lose some money on it because they see its value in the currency that it has.
That concept of running a money-losing publication for reasons of influence is almost as old as publishing itself, but it often feels like it's not as common as it once was. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just harder to justify losses, you know, for print media especially. You know, we're at a point where newspapers' advertising revenue in the past 10 years has more or less halved. We're looking at 2005, 2006, I think ad revenue was around $50 million for the newspaper industry. Today, it's closer to something like 20 million. So just to, and you know, circulation has plummeted for a lot of print publications. Many have folded. A new crop of digital startup media has risen. So I think it's more difficult to be an owner with money who, you know, really, you know, would find it worthwhile. But we're still seeing, you know, I mean, you look at some of the people who are going after publications lately, you know, in Las Vegas, you have Sheldon Adelson, you know, billionaire casino magnate and GOP mega donor buying the, or at least through his family buying the Las Vegas Review Journal. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, John Henry, the Boston Globe. There's still a lot of moguls out there who are snatching up print publications. And I think if you look at in New York and News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch, you know, he's still losing lots of money on the New York Post. And I think he probably still finds that to be a publication that gives him some influence. So I think it's not completely disappearing. It's just more, it's not as easy to be willing to sustain losses given how difficult the climate is for media compared to what it was 5, 10, 20 years ago.
I'm just looking at the distribution figures now. It was up at just over 100,000 back in 2000, but by 2010 it had dropped to just over 53,000. So as you say, quite a significant loss in its influence there. Just looking back to 2012 when Chris Hughes took over, he seemed to approach the magazine as a new media company, perhaps just another player in the race for readers against, say, the Huffington Post or the Daily Beast. There was talk of wanting to break things and turn it into what was termed a vertically integrated company. Do you think perhaps that was a large part of what went wrong here, at least in recent history anyway?
I think many people would agree with that statement. Felix Salmon just wrote an article on Fusion about the, you know, his big mistake was treating this magazine as a startup and, you know, not as this kind of like iconic historic legacy publication that it was. And I think, you know, just the New Republic, this was a very intellectual, elite, literary sort of brand. So I think it was very jarring when, you know, bringing in a CEO from a tech company, throwing around corporate jargon. You know, I think it was pretty jarring and troubling to the staff there and to a lot of people who appreciate the magazine. Again, this is like a thought leader publication. This isn't a tech startup. That sort of vertically integrated digital media company, this jargon, you know, just doesn't make sense in the context of what this publication is. And you know, I don't know you know, exactly what Chris Hughes or his team sees as the failure, but I don't think it helped certainly to kind of treat it more as, you know, kind of like a tech company or a product than a magazine. And you know, to be fair, the new editor that Chris Hughes brought in after this ousting of Franklin Foer, who had been an editor there for some time, and some of the other you know, longtime talent. I mean, they had a huge staff turnover after Franklin Foer was removed as editor, kind of as much of a revolt as you could imagine in terms of staff just resigning en masse. But the publication, you know, under Gabriel Snyder, who is a former Gawker editor, he was a media reporter for a long time. I think people do think he has been putting out a good magazine. And in recent days, since this news broke, I've still seen people saying, let's not forget that, you know, the New Republic has been looking pretty good lately as a magazine. But I think, you know, the broader frame of treating it as kind of like a product or a digital media product was probably, you know, a miscalculation.
Well, another miscalculation when it came to integrating print with the digital world affected a somewhat different publication. Newsweek was another prestigious title for many years, but during what we might call the Great Print Panic, as the internet was rising in popularity, the title eventually found itself under the control of the team behind the Daily Beast website. And the attempts to integrate the titles online were somewhat bizarre. It's since separated and returned to its original print form. Looking at Newsweek now, do you think it's a publication of confidence, one that comes across like it really knows what it's doing?
I think that right now, I think Newsweek, since it's come back in print, I think they do know exactly what they're doing. It is a very, it's a good-looking magazine. They're doing serious journalism. It's filled with reporting. They're reporting from conflict zones. They're doing everything that I guess Newsweek should be doing editorially, their model is vastly different. And the reason I think you probably perceive it not being this titan that it once was is because it simply isn't. You know, they are going after, they have a more of a premium boutique sort of model. Circulation is, you know, in the low hundreds of thousands globally. This is a magazine that commanded, drove the national conversation each week at a point and had, you know, several million readers in print. Those days are gone. Newsweek now, I think, is going after an audience who wants to read serious journalism, who appreciates a good-looking magazine and is willing to buy it for $7 or $8 on the newsstand. And I think that's the model that they are employing. And, you know, if we believe them, they say they're making some money, that they're turning a profit. So it's at the model that, if we take them at their word, appears to be working for them now.
Well, a return to print is certainly good news in the case of Newsweek, because, of course, print media, by its very nature, is not breaking news. It's a digestive. It's not enough to simply report facts anymore. You really need to be helping people make sense of what's happening. So it would seem it was a wise move for Newsweek, then, to turn itself into this sort of boutique product. Would you agree?
I think it's a wise business move because the overhead is so much lower. You're printing fewer copies. I mean, print costs are, you know, that's some of the biggest overhead for publications. And you look at staff, I mean, Newsweek, even under the era when it was merged with Newsbeast under the ownership of Barry Diller's IAC with Tina Brown at the helm, they were still kind of spending freely, had a large staff, big budgets. That just doesn't work. And the advertising wasn't there for them to sustain that. Newsweek now, you know, they have a much smaller staff. I believe it's something, you know, maybe 60 or 70 people. And again, they are doing original reporting. It's not kind of just conceptualizing the news cycle. And I think that's important too. Even if it's not breaking news, you need to give people something that's new that they haven't heard before. And, you know, from what I see, from what I read, I think that they are doing that. So I think it was a smart business move to try to make Newsweek succeed at a smaller scale. It's still, you know, the problem is it's still, there's a sense it doesn't have the weight that it once did. It's not as powerful as it once was, and it probably can never get that back because it's harder to do that when you're much smaller. And I think once, you know, a lot of damage has been done to your brand, it's hard to really come back and revive and be, you know, as much as an influential behemoth as you once were. But I do think it seems to be working for them right now.
Well, I also want to spend some time talking about some once mighty newspapers on today's show. But before we do that, I think it's important that we wind things right back to a time in New York City when the craft of journalism was still very much maturing and determining its core values. Back in the 1880s, the New York World was a daily paper selling for 2 cents. It didn't have very many readers, nor did it seem to know what it aspired to be. But all that changed when a man named Joseph Pulitzer stepped off a streetcar and became the publication's new owner. Monocle's Megan Gibson takes us back in time now to when journalism, scandalous and otherwise, came of age in New York.
On the day an ambitious young Joseph Pulitzer handed over $346,000 for the New York World, the struggling newspaper was already 23 years old. It had been established by a man called Alexander Cummings. He was a journalist from Philadelphia, but his vision for the paper was a far cry from the modern journalistic approach to America's working class that it would come to pioneer. As a daily title, selling for 1 cent, Cummings ran the paper as a sort of religious gazette. He penned editorials that sought to uplift the reader and shunned any mention of alcohol, lewd acts, or theatrical material that might offend. But his insistence on extending his staunchly conservative values to the advertising made profits rather hard to come by. Doubling the price to 2 cents made little difference, and he was eventually forced out. Things began to look up when the paper was taken over by a group of financiers, which included the mayor of New York, Fernando Wood. They installed a new editor, and for a time, the title operated as a de facto voice of the Democratic Party's political ambitions. But as the 1870s loomed, the public had worn tired of the paper's predictable approach to its commentary. The last few presidential elections had been won by Republicans, and its rival, the New York Sun, had garnered a serious reputation that proved difficult to compete with. It briefly came under the control of a Mr. Thomas Scott, a railroad magnate who, despite installing the respected William Henry Hurlburt as editor, proved entirely incapable as a publisher. By 1880, the ailing New York World was under the control of a man named Jay Gould. He recounted his purchase in a book published in 1924.
I never intended to have the paper, and I got it more by accident than by design, almost against my desire. The way of it was this. In the summer of 1878 or 1879, I met with Mr. Tom Scott of the Pennsylvania Railroad in Switzerland, in Bern. Mr. Scott was very much depressed and broken up, financially, physically, and mentally. I felt a profound sympathy for him. He asked me as a favor to take his Texas Pacific Railroad off his hands, and I concluded to do so. In arranging the details, Mr. Scott appealed to me to include the World in the transaction. He owned it absolutely. I cared nothing about it, but finally yielded.
When the morning of May 9th, 1883 dawned, the New York World was a faded scrapbook of disparate influences. That was the day a Mr. Joseph Pulitzer stepped off a streetcar in downtown Manhattan and, at the age of just 36, became the newest player in the city's newspaper scene. He recruited the pioneering investigative journalist Nellie Bly, famous for an exposé piece on the treatment of mental health patients, something she obtained by faking insanity. It's a story that likely sounds familiar to fans of American Horror Story. Under Pulitzer's leadership, the newspaper was booming. Circulation skyrocketed from 15,000 to 600,000. It was soon the largest newspaper in America. In 1921, the paper featured a series of exposé pieces on the Ku Klux Klan after its revival following the popular D.W. Griffith film, The Birth of a Nation. Much of the New York World's success can be traced to Pulitzer's supreme talent for appealing to the working man. He emphasized illustrations, calls for reform, news from the entertainment industries, and a culture rich in advertising and consumption. It even published the first crossword puzzle. Some years after Pulitzer's death in 1911, the title was sold off and in 1931 was folded into rival publication, The Evening Telegram. 9 years later, the hectic world of newspapermen was immortalized in the Hollywood classic, His Girl Friday. By this time, it was clear. Pulitzer's influence on journalism and newspapers had helped the profession mature into one of the most respected industries in the world.
Monocle's Megan Gibson there, recounting one of the world's most influential and often forgotten newspapers, the New York World. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this short break.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're back with The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Joe Pompeo from Politico Media is still with me, joining us from our bureau in New York City. Joe, let's consider the New York Daily News now, that screeching tabloid that's often more famous internationally for being the home of the Daily Planet newspaper from the old Superman movies. Where does it fit into the city's news climate?
Well, Daily News in New York City historically has very much been sort of like a populist newspaper. Its slogan has been New York's hometown newspaper. So we think of working class people, not just in Manhattan, but more importantly in the five boroughs, reading this paper. And, you know, it's very much kind of always seen itself as kind of like a paper for the people, you know, versus the New York Post has had kind of also this elite Manhattan-centric audience that kind of gobbles it up for its Page Six coverage and society coverage and things like that. But the Daily News, you know, is a different proposition. And it has definitely fallen on hard times over the past few years. And as with the New York Post, both of their circulation has, you know, really seen a precipitous decline. Daily News, I think at its peak, had a couple million readers. It was, you know, one of the, if I think at one point it was the largest newspaper in America, and it still is among the newspapers in America that have the circulation in the ranking of the top 10 most widely read newspapers. But, you know, I think now we're talking an average weekday circulation of around 250,000. So in the past few years, the Daily News has done what a lot of publications are trying to do, going after big national scale online, churning out lots of stories from all over, you know, weird stories from all over the U.S., celebrity stories that are going to get a lot of people reading and clicking. So it's kind of a much different identity online than, you know, in print, in terms of, you know, people in New York who are actually still picking up that newspaper because they want to know what crime or what, you know, political battles have heated up in New York City versus online. It's kind of like this mail online style, you know, big collection of wild headlines from all over the place. So it's kind of, you know, a dual identity publication at this time, and one that is losing a lot of money and, you know, trying to right the ship like a lot of newspapers are.
Now, as I understand it, the Daily News was the first newspaper in America to use the tabloid format, which was a key part of its approach to forging a place for itself amongst its competitors. New York's subway system was about 20 years old at the time, and seeing men struggling to read their big, burly broadsheets while riding the increasingly crowded cars, its founder targeted commuters with an easily read format containing, shall we say, just as easily digestible content. Do you think that business approach directly impacted its editorial style?
I think that, you know, kind of trying to recall my journalism history, I think tabloid newspapers generally, you're right, these were seen as commuter papers. These are papers that you can unfold easily and read on a train. Broadsheets are these big unwieldy things that maybe if you are in the back seat of a car in the morning being shuttled to work, or even farther back in a horse and carriage or something. I mean, you could see how the tabloid catered to you know, a more, I think, working class audience from the beginning. So I think that historically probably just informed the direction, not just the Daily News, but, you know, all tabloids I think it's informed the mission that all tabloids have tried to deliver on, and it's certainly true of the New York Post as well. You know, some people would say these are kind of tabloids are down market, but that's, you know, I think that these are papers ultimately that, you know, have a larger working class audience, working class readership, and by virtue of their size, they are smaller. They are kind of getting to the point. They are sensational, you know, more direct, have a little bit more flair. So I just think that's kind of historically just been the identity of all tabloids for a long time. Not necessarily just the Daily News, and I don't know that you know has been something that has ultimately led to their financial troubles, because they were successful for a very long time. They did make money for many years, whereas the New York Post has always famously lost money. So I don't think that, you know, being a tabloid is suggestive of being something that cannot be sustainable. In England, as you know, the tabloids are still selling a lot of copies on the newsstand. It's kind of a different culture there. What's happened in New York, as we've seen, you know, people in America, I think it's not as much of a newsstand culture. And, you know, as again, with the rise of digital media and so many more choices for news, I just think there's fewer people who are going out to the newsstand to buy that tabloid newspaper every day. And I think that's what's really happened over the past 10 years.
Well, no doubt it would be silly to compare these two papers to something like the New York Times. But just looking at that publication for a moment, it's done an amazing job at clawing back many of its readers with a variety of methods. Online or not, it feels like a premium product. How do you think that the Post and the Daily News compare just in that respect?
The New York Times is just such a different... I mean, the New York Times has national, global scale. It's the paper of record in the U.S., arguably around the world. It's kind of, you know, apples and oranges to compare them. Really, what the News and the Post have always done differently is they do stories that, you know, probably the more upmarket readership of the Times, you know, wouldn't care about. They do more stories about things that are happening in the five boroughs. And, you know, I think their audience cares about different types of stories than the audience of the Times. So, you know, it's hard to compare them apples to apples. Financially, they are certainly in a much, you know, more precarious position than the New York Times. You know, the New York Times makes money. It's struggled greatly with the diminution of ad revenue. But, you know, there's still, they now have 1 million people paying to read them digitally. And that's been, you know, huge for them in terms of, you know, finding a business model that will sustain them into the future. The Daily News and the New York Post, they've also struggled with, you know, the fallout of print advertising and their circulation. Like I said, it's plummeted in the past 10 years greatly. And, you know, the New York Post, they keep their losses, their finances pretty close to the vest, and News Corp, their parent company, does not disclose them, but, you know, it's believed to lose tens of millions of dollars. The Daily News, you know, it's been reported, and sources have told me as well, that it's believed to be, have been losing more than $20 million a year. So this is you know, a much different business proposition at this point than the New York Times, which is in a much better financial state. So it's kind of difficult to compare them, but safe to say that they're struggling for sure.
Perhaps a victory for quality journalism then. Joe Pompeo from Politico Media, thanks very much for joining me today on The Stack. And that does bring us to the end of this week's show. My thanks today to our editor, Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note over at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again and catch up over at monocle.com or via iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack with me, Ben Ryland. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.